Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. WGLT Hall of Famer and longtime blues host Gilbert Frank Black died Sunday of COVID-related complications. He was 79 years old. Black served as a blues music host from 1985 until he retired in 2013. WGLT's John Norton remembers the man many knew as Delta Frank, the blues doctor.
The nickname stuck because of Black's knowledge of and deep love of blues music, his infectious enthusiasm both on and off air, and his passionate down-home Southern style showmanship.
This is Give Me Back My Wig. Yeah, from Bill Hargis out of Towanda.
Frank was a tireless ambassador for the blues in central Illinois and had a visceral connection to his listeners. When the spirit moved him, which was often, Frank would turn on his microphone in the middle of a song and sing or hum along to that song. He might even talk back to the song or tell it to get along as if he were riding that song like a horse.
That's the Reverend of the Blues, the Reverend of the Blues, R.L. Burnside from Holly Springs, Mississippi. Good afternoon, Delta Frank, your blues doctor. Here's Slim Harpo's first song right here.
Well, I'm a king.
Yeah. Look out now, look out.
Buzzing around.
The door is open, open up, come on in.
Listeners loved his emotional and at times irreverent personality. They would call him to request songs, to swap stories, or to pour their heart out to him, often all three in the same call. At area events, especially blues festivals, he was a rock star. His voice was instantly recognized, and every listener felt they knew him. Bloomington's Deb Melberg did know him. She and her harmonica-wielding husband, Steve, have been an integral part of the Bloomington Normal blues scene since the early 1990s. She is both a festival promoter and a board member of the Blues Blowtorch Society.
He draws you in because he's so personable and he's honest, and you believe everything he says because you know he's lived it, he's been there, he's done that.
Frank Black's tenure at WGLT began in 1985. The story goes his sister-in-law, Jan Turner, encouraged him to approach WGLT after hearing Frank play and DJ blues records every weekend all night long in the family living room. Then WGLT program director Tim Emmons gave him a chance. He hired Frank to host a new show called the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame. It was a series of one-hour recorded shows featuring Frank's immense 45 RPM collection.
I literally remember giving my younger daughter a bath a couple of months after we got to town, and I was listening to that show, and I was thinking, this guy is something.
That's former general manager Bruce Bergathon. He says the most intuitive programming decision he ever made was in 1989 when he asked Frank to take his recorded show live on the air.
All of the passion and enthusiasm that went into his collecting and the knowledge that he had kind of came together. I think when we fundraised that show back in April of 89, we were just astonished at how many people gave money and positive feedback. I mean, in public radio, when you raise money on a show, that means that something's happening.
It was those live shows in the late 1980s and early 90s where his personality really broke through and the legend began. That personality also helped ignite a vibrant central Illinois blues scene. He introduced listeners to new music names like Slim Harpo and Lazy Lester, as well as obscure blues record labels like VJ, Modern, and Excello. Frank was the membership director of the Bloomington-based Blues Blowtorch Society and a must-have MC for any blues concert or festival in the area. And he introduced Central Illinois to a blues vernacular. Now, he didn't invent this phrase,
have mercy,
or this admonishment.
And if you don't like blues, you got a hole in your soul.
But he did make them his own. Those and other phrases became ubiquitous among Central Illinois blues fans and on his blues radio show.
So you're down in the alley with Delta Frank, the blues doctor.
And Frank truly believed what he was saying. Frank loved blues music. He wanted you to love blues music. He called himself the blues doctor, but he was as much a preacher as he was a doctor. As in, if you didn't like the blues or were unsure about making a commitment, he would figuratively reach through the radio, grab you by your lapel, and demand that you love blues as much as he loved blues. Frank's life was difficult at times, especially early on. He claimed Lickskillet, Alabama as his hometown, but mostly grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee and Huntsville, Alabama. He occasionally talked about the time he and his sister lived temporarily in foster care. He also talked about living out of his car while working road construction after he moved to Decatur, Illinois in the 1970s. He admitted to doing what he called bad things with other nasty people at that time. But he said his life began to turn around when he met his beloved wife, Marilyn, who he called a saint till the day he died. The two married in 1975 after meeting at Parents Without Partners in Decatur 10 months prior. Marilyn said he made an immediate impression on her.
I was fascinated with the voice. And he was a little sick, so it was a little hoarse or whatever, but it was still that deep and that raspy stuff and that southern stuff.
And Frank? Well, he was equally smitten.
She was a knockout, man. She's beautiful and still is.
And he always gave credit to Marilyn for letting him come up to WGLT every weekend for 29 years. That is, every Friday and Saturday night to play his blues music on the radio. He said if he was married to anyone else, that probably never would have happened.
That is so wonderful to have an angel for a wife, because she never, ever complained about me being gone on Saturday or Friday night or whatever.
Despite Frank's pre-Marilyn history, his stories, and to be fair, some of them became tall over the years, tended to celebrate his love of the South. He told people how much he loved frog gigging. Frank loved talking about Southern food, including cornbread, collard greens, and grits. And he loved to admonish us Northerners for having basements, because nobody in the South had basements. That just brings water problems, right? And he loved regaling people about the first time he heard the blues.
1955.
This is a WGLT promotional announcement from 2004.
I'm listening to radio. Whatever will be, will be. I don't want to hear Doris Day. I'm looking around. I cross 1510 WLAC Nashville, and I'm hearing this song, Lightning Slim Hicks, just made 21. That's the first blues record I ever heard.
Folks, I remember.
I got up the next morning and took the old KTL bus downtown Knoxville, and I bought the record for 69 cents, man.
Later, Frank remembered helping a bookstore owner clean up and was rewarded with a ton of old blues records, or at least most of them were blues, that the owner didn't want. And yes, that was the beginning of what became a jaw-dropping library of rare 45 RPM records, most rated excellent to mint condition. He sold those records to collectors around the country and around the world, but mostly he enjoyed playing them at family gatherings. Marilyn said he would play them all night long for whoever would stop by to visit them at their home in Clinton. In the early days, those blues 45s were mostly what he would play on WGLT. Retired general manager Bruce Bergethon remembers Frank would lug two suitcases bursting with 45s to the station every weekend so he could play them on the radio. And even in the later days, when he was mostly playing CDs, Frank would occasionally slip in one of those 45s and proudly say, "Folks, you ain't gonna hear that anywhere else but right here, because this comes from my personal record collection." Well, that blues library is now gone. He sold it a couple of years ago to a collector from somewhere out west. And now Frank is gone. The mouth of the South roars no more. No more will you hear the man who claimed Lickskillet, Alabama as his hometown.
Doctor, the voice of Lickskillet, Alabama, how you doing this afternoon?
By the way, you know there is no Lickskillet, Alabama, right? For the lucky few, he would give you a wink every once in a while, maybe an embarrassed smile, and then he would uncharacteristically lower his voice to say, "You know, there is no Lickskillet. It's just a thing." Frank came out of retirement for a final hurrah 3 years after his initial retirement. This is when he agreed to play his 50 favorite blues songs of all time during WGLT's 50th anniversary celebration in May of 2016. And once again, he whooped and hollered and played blues music like he did in the old days. And the listeners, oh man, boy, did they react. Every single phone caller seemed stunned and thrilled to hear his voice once again. There was a lot of story swapping, and boy, there was a lot of love back and forth from both Frank and his listeners. And yeah, there were some tears. Matter of fact, every single phone call, if it didn't end in tears, it seemed like it was headed that way.
Delta Frank here, GLT. How you doing?
Good. Nice to hear you.
Who is this?
Tammy. I wrote something down I want to read to you.
Okay.
Okay. I'll try. I got to calm down now. Hey, Frank. You are a really good doctor. You got me through a lot. At times that I would be down and out. And then when I knew that I was going to hear your good old blues caring voice, I was good to go. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Tammy Simpson.
Thank you so much for calling us, Tammy. We love you. Okay, I love you.
Love you, Frank.
Bye-bye.
You know that saying, they don't make them like that anymore? Well, they don't. R.I.P. Gilbert Delta Frank Black, the Blues Doctor. I'm John Norton.
Hey, girl.
Coming up later this week, we will have a special hour devoted to Delta Frank. We will shout that from the rooftops as soon as we have a date and time. This is Sound Ideas. COVID-19 is so entrenched in daily life that some may not have noticed how it's bled onto the screen. From subtle mask wearing to celebrations of essential workers, the pandemic has made its way into commercials and entertainment alike. Dana Vollmer has more on what messages these portrayals send.
If you turned on your TV in March after states started shutting down industry and asking people to stay at home, you likely heard something like this.
Fear has no place here. Only love. Resilience, kindness, and strength. A collective strength that can move mountains and heal communities.
Messages of community and strength were rampant back then, when the scope of the virus's impact was still unknown. Illinois State University media professor Warren Bratzlavsky says that has evolved over time.
In the first month or so, the commercials were all like that very rah-rah support of first responders, and we're going to push through this without kind of knowing how long the pandemic would be.
More recently, those messages have become somewhat less on the nose. Face coverings and social distancing is often seen on screen, normalized in the same way they've been in real life. Take, for example, a pizza delivery person dropping off food in a branded Domino's mask.
At Domino's, we pride ourselves on handcrafted pizza. But after leaving our 450-degree ovens, the only hands that touch them are yours. Mix and match any two or more for just $5.99 each and get them with contactless delivery from Domino's.
Bratzlavsky says this isn't by accident. She says it's a method of inspiring confidence in consumers that they can still buy things and it will be safe. It's also a way to try to prove corporate responsibility. Bratzlavsky gives this hypothetical.
Say, like, if Amazon warehouses are having, like, an outbreak of COVID, and then you have an ad from Amazon showing the workers at the warehouses wearing masks as part of this inspirational, again, message about, you know, what they're doing to protect people.
Amazon, in fact, did have an ad campaign in March highlighting their essential workers. The company reported in October that nearly 20,000 of them had tested positive. A more recent Amazon ad portrays a young dancer who overcomes challenges to perform. Its tagline was, "The show must go on." Bratzlavsky says for any company, this can be a form of damage control.
Whether or not maybe that company has a track record or not of treating employees well, but at least if in their advertising they show how they're taking care of their employees, and that's one way to spin that kind of a message.
Bratzlavsky says these corporate responsibility signals aren't likely to rock the boat, especially if the companies are still trying to appeal to a broad audience. She says the message you're most likely to see is wear a mask. But she says messages that undermine the severity of the pandemic could be more subtle.
What is not there is as important as what is there. So if we have a lot of ads, for example, that would feature people wearing masks, and there's an ad where a person is not wearing a mask, and it's a situation where it's pretty evident that a person could be or ought to be wearing a mask, then that does seem like a sort of way of going against that grain.
Where there's more latitude to make a splash, she says, is entertainment. Late-night television has seen more changes than nearly any other genre, with the exception, perhaps, of reality TV. Hosts are taping from home or sitting alone in an audience-free studio, but that hasn't stopped them from riffing on the mayhem. Here's Trevor Noah's show after President Trump contracted COVID-19.
As a comedian, I'm not going to lie, my first instinct was to make jokes. jokes about how a 74-year-old man who doesn't eat vegetables and eats way too much meat is literally the kind of guy that Corona puts in its dating profile.
The punchline is less comedic and more honest. If the president of the United States got the virus, despite all of the resources at his disposal, what excuse does anyone else have to not wear a mask? Other comedy shows have latched on as well. South Park hosted an entire coronavirus special last month. That episode scored the series its highest ratings in 7 years. The show's running joke was chin diapers. That's what its writers named the phenomenon of wearing a mask down around your chin instead of covering your mouth and nose.
Butters, for the last time, you can't go to Build-A-Bear.
But they said they were open again, so...
Yes, they're open, but we are not the Johnsons, and we do not go to non-essential businesses when it's non-essential. Hey, do you people mind? You're supposed to wear your mask over your nose. It looks like you're wearing a diaper for your chin. Chin diapers don't help.
Brotzlovsky says the animated nature of the show makes the commentary less cringy than seeing real people breaking health guidance. She notes the anxiety many people say they feel when they see a party or concert crowd on screen during COVID times, even if it's old footage.
There's definitely differences, I think, in what a cartoon can do versus a TV show can do or live action can do. And then on the live action side of it, it's are they replicating our kind of fatigued, zoomed out lives that we have, or kind of more what we might experience in our home bubbles.
Other shows have opted to incorporate COVID into their storylines and means of production. Shows like NBC's Connecting and Netflix's Social Distance use a Zoom-style format. Some court dramas have featured remote hearings, much like real life. Brotzlovsky says there's nothing to really compare the impact of COVID-19 in media to. She says in the future, media archives from the COVID-19 pandemic will examine where and when these themes arose, what the context of production was, and what audiences they served were worried about at the time. I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. 4 months ago, as systemic racism again boiled over in the U.S., State Farm made a big move. It appointed its first chief diversity officer, Victor Terry. State Farm's senior vice president, Annette Martinez, says diversity and inclusion are not brand new things for the company. She calls Terry's new job the next step in a long evolution. In part two of our interview, Martinez talks about her own work launching State Farm's diversity initiatives 18 years ago.
From that time, as we looked at, we launched employee resource groups, which a lot of organizations do. We've had kind of this evolution of, building our metrics, looking at development opportunities, building different support systems for our associates, recruiting. So all the things you would think about in a traditional D&I work. We knew that as more companies were going to this chief diversity officer concept, we knew that there was an opportunity for us to name somebody in particular. And this year just seemed like the right year. There are a lot of things that came together as we were thinking about, kind of what happened in society and how, as an organization, we stood up and said, we can't stay silent to the inequities that are clearly happening. And so we've had this long history of really positive work around D&I. This just felt like the right year for us to say we're going to take another step, and the chief diversity officer role gives us a chance to say we're all in, we're committed, we're going to continue this work. And so, and Victor's done a fabulous job of just jumping in and has some really good plans for moving forward as well. So in our minds, it was kind of this, we had talked about the role earlier on. I had served in that capacity in a lot of ways, but to really name somebody and have somebody that is focused on this work day in, day out, we think is just really positive stuff. So it was just right timing in our minds.
So how do you craft a position like that so that Victor Terry is set up for success? There's been a lot of reporting out there about corporate diversity officers being hired, given the shiny title, but not having the power to actually change culture within an organization. So what's your approach?
Yeah, so from the very beginning, what was wonderful about our diversity initiatives is we always reported up through the CEO, and at the time I actually reported the chief operating officer, and so that's, we've always had very high level support from our executive CEO and our highest level leaders. That has never changed. And I think that is one of the very key things that will help Victor in the role of CDO, is that really having that pipeline and guidance from that. So for us, I think it's a continuation. He wasn't coming in to rescue the organization. He wasn't coming in to start something brand new. But we do understand that D&I never, this work never ends. And we certainly saw that this year. And so as he thinks about the future, he just put together what we're calling a governance council. And so that's a group of 10 high senior executives in the organization that are going to help with the future strategy for the work. He's looking at how to have even more robust metrics. And we're talking a lot about, you know, transparency and conversations that we're having with our associates, really open dialogue with our associates. So I think it's a continuation of the work, but a really nice time to kind of just say, let's take it to the next level. So I feel like he's really coming at a very positive time. A lot of the other companies you mentioned, their chief diversity officer is starting from the ground level, and he doesn't have to do that. So that's why I just am very confident in where we're moving.
Where do you see the biggest room for improvement on diversity and inclusion at State Farm right now?
So something we've really focused on this year, which I really has felt had been the area that we could work on the most, and we've had a series of what we're calling just kind of conversations worth having, just really honest conversations within our organization about race relations, inequities, things that we're seeing in the world around us. That had probably been a hesitation for us. You know, it can be a volatile topic for some people, and it has just been incredibly powerful this year. So the first session we had, I believe, around 4,000 participants that listened in, where we were really just having honest conversations about from people who've experienced racism, from people who've experienced or had to manage their children through these types of issues or personally have had issues. That one had, again, around 4,500. The next session that we did had double that participants. So just really having these honest conversations about things that perhaps workplace is hard. Sometimes it's hard for people to have the conversation. And we've gotten such positive feedback around it just feels that I can be honest with who I am and my experiences and that somebody else is listening to them too. So I think that's starting kind of this new trend moving forward. And I think it was our biggest opportunity to really start taking it to that next level.
At State Farm, Senior Vice President Annette Martinez. You can find part one of our interview about recruitment and retention at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. This is 89.1 FM, WGLT, WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.